This is JAMDA On The Go, your review of the content featured in JAMDA, the research-focused monthly journal of AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now, here's your host for JAMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to JAMDA On The Go. This podcast will spotlight articles from the August 2020 issue of JAMDA, the Journal of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. We will be speaking once again with JAMDA co-editor-in-chief, Dr. Philip Sloan, and associate editor, Dr. Mallory Brown. Dr. Sloan is a family physician and geriatrician with a master's degree in public health. He is the Elizabeth and Oscar Goodwin Distinguished Professor of Family Medicine and Geriatrics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and co-director for the Program on Aging, Disability, and Long-Term Care at the Cecil G. Shepp Center for Health Services Research. Dr. Brown is also a family physician and geriatrician at the University of North Carolina, where she is an associate professor of family medicine and director of the residency training program. Drs. Brown and Sloan, welcome back to JAMDA On The Go.
Great to be with you, Wayne.
Thanks, Wayne.
So the August 2020 issue of JAMDA is once again replete with interesting articles from the United States and across the world. We start today's discussion with an editorial on telemedicine in the era of COVID-19. Doctors Suzanne Gillespie and Stephen Handler have been advocating for telemedicine in the nursing home setting for years, with Dr. Gillespie heading the Society's telehealth workgroup and Dr. Handler leading the CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, innovation project RAVEN on using telemedicine to reduce potentially avoidable hospital stays. Alex Bardock, the Society's head of public policy, and his team have been working to help us all to navigate through the changing telehealth regulation. Together, one of their editorial's conclusions was that healthcare's relationship with telemedicine has the opportunity to be forever changed as a result of the COVID-19 global pandemic. So many stories during this international crisis that have led us to a change in the approach to medical care. Dr. Brown, what are your thoughts on this evolution of telemedicine?
Well, Wayne, we've talked, as you said, a lot over the past few months about COVID-19 and how it might change the way we provide care in the long-term care setting, particularly around telemedicine. When I'm feeling really down in the dumps about this whole awful pandemic, one bright light has repeatedly been the rapid changes around the reimbursement for telemedicine. I've had the pleasure of providing telemedicine, and I do believe that this is fantastic and can really increase our ability to meet our patients where they are and when they need us in a really meaningful way. So to speak about this particular editorial, just a year ago, AMDA leaders were on Capitol Hill advocating for policy changes related to the post-acute and long-term care telemedicine setting. An argument was made to revise payment to allow this model to be more feasible, particularly in rural settings and for specialist visits. Fast forward to today, and significant shifts in policy and payment have been made. Rational changes in regulations guiding telemedicine in nursing homes and the need for thoughtful infection prevention have inspired a new opportunity for innovation and vision for how high-quality care can be accessed in nursing homes. Let's back up and re-examine why long-term care facilities are such a critical and ideal venue for telemedicine. We know patients in nursing homes are increasingly complex, therefore needing care, perhaps more than just when a clinician may be on site in the facility. As a clinician who works in long-term care, I'm often called by nursing staff on nights, weekends, and randomly when I'm on call, but I'm rarely, if ever, on site during these nights and weekend time. We certainly know that this can lead to misdiagnosis and therefore delay in the best care, and unfortunately, an overuse of the emergency department. Medical directors and clinicians alike have believed for many years that telemedicine would benefit patients and a growing amount of feasibility studies also have supported this concept. With COVID-19, this has been highlighted further. Telemedicine allows for actual or suspected COVID-positive residents to be treated in place when their care goals support this. This concept of forward triage can allow for resident assessment in the nursing home using telemedicine to optimize survival and resources while reducing the risk of community spread and limiting exposure of other healthcare personnel to COVID-19. Fortunately, CMS has made some radical changes in the face of COVID-19 and at the end of March removed the once-a-month limitation for subsequent care visits, initial visits, and discharge services to the list of Medicare reimbursable telehealth services. Basically, all face-to-face regulatory visits can now be completed using telehealth tools and paid at the same rate as the face-to-face visit. Additionally, the regulations around restricted reimbursement to rural nursing homes have also been lifted. I completely agree with the authors of this editorial when they state, as we ride the momentum of change, it's important for us to continue to expand our understanding of how telemedicine tools are best used in care. The interconnected relationship between patient population, the reason for the medical visit, and the modality of telemedicine used needs to be further refined for us to deliver the highest value care. How can we use telemedicine most effectively moving forward? The AMTA Telemedicine Workgroup conducted a study of the perceived value of subspecialty telemedicine that showed that dermatology, geriatric psychiatry, and infectious disease were the specialties that long-term care practitioners would consult the most if they were available by telemedicine. In addition, I know in my own practice, we're investigating telemedicine with many of my subspecialty colleagues at the university to keep folks safe and in place. Gone are the days that we need to see each person in person to provide the best care. As a long-term care practitioner, we must continue to explore these new reimbursed models to improve the services to our residents.
It's amazing. Gone are the days, as you have said. And thank you, Dr. Brown. This really brings together the issues around telemedicine that many people are talking about and the innovation that can be done. And speaking of that, our next article to review is a discussion around a novel telemedicine program by Low and others in Singapore, where six geriatrics and telemedicine trained doctors took turns to conduct teleconsultations with patients of the nursing homes on a regular as well as an ad hoc basis. Dr. Brown, what did this team show with what they call simple video broadcasting?
This prospective study was ongoing before this wild time in our history. But of course, it's incredibly interesting to the JAMDA community right now. Over 6.5 years, 8 nursing homes in Singapore referred nursing home patients to a teleconsultation practice with a geriatric medicine department. The individual telemedicine consults were observed and studied for dates, demographics, medical comorbidities, reasons for referral, physical exam findings, primary diagnosis, and general management plans. 850 patients were enrolled, and from that group, 1,673 teleconsultations were completed. The main reasons for referral were for medication review, this was about 50%, and behavioral problems, 22%. The 4 most common comorbidities were hypertension, 57% of the patients, dementia, 40%, diabetes, 39%, and hyperlipidemia, 38%. The most common primary diagnosis was dementia, of which 227 of those diagnosed were referred for behavioral and psychological symptoms of dementia. The study ultimately found that a telemedicine service for older patients is feasible and can be done with high quality, particularly if there is a great demand, as there is currently. I'll be honest, I questioned where I could use telemedicine in my geriatric practice early on. Will my patients have a hard time using the technology, I thought? Will they be willing to not come into the office for an actual face-to-face visit? Will patients feel like they're receiving the same level of care? My experience as a geriatric practitioner has been mixed. The young old, as we call them, have embraced this model. They're happy to jump on the video chat and talk through the issues they're having with plans to see one another down the road for labs or for other check-ins. Many of them are able to do their own vitals at home. Family members who may otherwise not be included in a visit due to limits on people in the facility are happily able to participate in this way as well. That said, technology has been a barrier for some of my patients who have been developing cognitive impairment, anxiety, or just have general frustration with technology. And these people living in nursing homes actually do better with telehealth than those in independent living because of some of the supports that are around them. So I think that the work that was done here is supporting that, yes, telehealth can be done and can be done well, but I still question it, and I think there are some settings that particularly support our residents or our patients to be better off with regards to telehealth. This study was interesting and certainly something we'll need to continue to refine and fine-tune comes from the work that they did.
Yeah, and I do like your distinction between older adults in the nursing facility setting and older adults in traditional primary care settings. We have one of my relatives who lives at home she's in her 80s. She had some abdominal discomfort and called her primary care doctor, who asked her to press on her belly and see if she had any discomfort. And so I think that may be the limitation of where telemedicine may not be too helpful, but I could definitely see in a supported environment in the nursing home setting with medical professionals around to support the interaction of the provider on the other side of the screen or on the phone. I could see how that would work. Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah, I think I'm always so grateful when there's someone else there, because it's so difficult to do physical exam or to really know that the patient has received what I've said. Yeah. And I've been really grateful when I've done telehealth visits to folks in nursing homes where they have that support, or to folks that live at home with a child or a significant other who can provide that layer and that level of care. The whole physical exam piece is so difficult and something we focus a lot of time and attention on with our medical residents and medical students, just in how do you do a physical exam over video chat? It is increasingly difficult to direct someone to show you on their phone what their lower extremity looks like.
Well, so pardon the pun, but stay tuned on the evolution of telemedicine. Let's switch gears to some work on prescribing. The August 2020 issue of JAMDA has two papers reporting research on prescribing that are particularly relevant for clinicians in the post-acute long-term care setting. I am personally always taken by how JAMDA brings forward research from multiple countries or locales. In this case, in the first paper, we'll be discussing research from China, Australia, the UK, and Thailand. They all got together to talk about the use of anticoagulation in patients with dementia who have atrial fibrillation. With the foundational statement, underuse of stroke prophylaxis in people with dementia may contribute to increased stroke and mortality. Dr. Brown, tell us about this study and what we can learn from it.
I love a study that tells you exactly what it's about in the title, Wayne. This work, it looked to determine the risks of embolic events, bleeding, and mortality with direct oral anticoagulants, DOACs, versus warfarin in people with atrial fibrillation and dementia. This is particularly interesting to me because I see so many patients affected by both AFib and dementia, and it leaves us with a tough management question to answer. Compared with the general population with atrial fibrillation, people with AFib and dementia have twice the risk of stroke and about 10 to 50% increased death risk. Underuse of stroke prophylaxis in people with dementia may contribute to increased stroke and mortality. Dementia alone is not an absolute contraindication to stroke prevention. However, a meta-analysis of 21 studies demonstrates that people with atrial fibrillation and dementia have about 52% lower odds of receiving Coumadin or warfarin than those without dementia. Underuse may be attributable to concern about an increased bleeding risk in people with dementia, and some studies have indeed supported this, particularly with intracranial bleeds. Landmark trials of several of the DOACs, or dabigatran and rivaroxaban, as well as apixaban, compared with warfarin, demonstrated at least equal effectiveness to warfarin for cerebral and systemic embolism prevention, with a reduced risk of intracranial bleeds. However, those landmark trials did not include representative samples of people like our patients who have dementia. So this study is the first I know of to look more closely at dementia patients in this situation. It's always a tough discussion for me to have with family members, so I was particularly interested to see what this study showed. As I said before, the researchers here investigated risk of bleeding and embolic events in those patients taking a direct oral anticoagulant versus warfarin, and they did so using a new user retrospective cohort study looking at the Health Improvement Network database from 2010 to 2017. Risk of ischemic stroke, transient ischemic attack or systemic embolism, all-cause mortality, intracranial bleed, or gastrointestinal bleeding and other bleeding were compared for the direct oral anticoagulants versus warfarin. Overall, about 2,400 people with atrial fibrillation and dementia initiated direct oral anticoagulants, 42% of that subsample, or Coumadin, 58% of that sample. Before propensity score adjustment, patients who initiated direct oral anticoagulants were older and had more comorbidities. After adjustment, direct oral anticoagulant initiators demonstrated similar risks of ischemic stroke, transient ischemic attack or systemic embolism, ischemic stroke alone, and other bleeding, but reduced intracranial bleeding risk compared with warfarin. Increased risk of GI bleeding and all-cause mortality were observed in direct oral anticoagulant initiators compared with warfarin. People with atrial fibrillation and dementia initiated on DOACs demonstrated a reduced risk of intracranial bleeding and similar risks of embolic events and other bleeding. But an increased risk of all-cause mortality and GI bleeding compared with warfarin users. It's unclear to what extent this finding reflects altered effects of anticoagulation in people with dementia or results from residential confounding arising from channeling of direct oral anticoagulants to our older and more frail patients. More safety studies are needed to demonstrate and to understand the efficacy of direct oral anticoagulants in patients with dementia.
Yeah, I'm not sure if this paper is going to change anyone's mind right away regarding direct oral anticoagulants versus Coumadin. Or even impact conversations with family members. I know that for the hospital, putting somebody on a novel agent is much easier. I am likely to give these direct agents to my older, more frail folks with atrial fibrillation and finding of dementia as a way of just limiting their need for INR, for lab draws. Interesting study. More work, I think, is needed in my mind. It really does also make me think about how it does take a village to come together and provide the best care to these very complicated, very medically complex patients in long-term care.
Absolutely.
So our next paper is from a United States and a United Kingdom team taking a novel point of view that is so obviously needed that we in long-term care and geriatrics just don't think about it. I was just amazed at this paper. And it makes us hit our heads in astonishment. That is, what should a pill size be and look like and taste like if we're going to successfully prescribe it to our medically complex older adults? Tell us, Dr. Sloan, what can we learn from this fascinating review article in the August 2020 issue of JAMDA?
Wayne, I enjoyed reading this review because it put into words what we all know, which is that some pills are easier to swallow than others. And it also brought me up to a higher level on this topic, and some of which was actually useful, even though it was a review paper of 14 articles, and it went on a little longer than most of us would like. But it really made a number of clinically relevant pointers. And the first take-home point really was a reminder to ask our patients if they have trouble swallowing things, including pills. I don't know about you, but I haven't been in the habit of asking every patient about pill swallowing problems before writing a prescription, even in long-term care settings.
You know, it just makes me think we've invested a lot of time and money into determining the relationships between genomes and medications and tolerability. Perhaps we should just be looking at those horse pills and ask ourselves, you know, would we ever want to take this medication? Can I even swallow that thing?
And the ironic thing is that the patient will tell you, well, it's that yellow pill, it looks like this. And you know, we usually don't have any idea what the pill looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, if we don't ask, you know, we certainly may not tell us. Even if it's a renewal. And it's important because about 80% of people who have swallowing difficulties will also prefer a modified dosage form, like a liquid or a chewable form. So how do we think about it? Well, we have to ask. Now, when it comes to the pills themselves, the obvious thing we know is that size matters. This review estimated that size is the number one issue causing pill swallowing difficulty, but it only accounts for about a third of pill swallowing problems. So there are other factors involved. Now, interestingly, a pill that's too small can also cause problems, especially for people with low vision or problems with manual dexterity. Now, I had a little pill I had to take for a while. I was always falling on the floor and I had to find it. And so I can understand that. So there's gotta be a happy medium. Now, the second most common cause of pill-related swallowing problems was not size or shape, it was the texture of the pill surface. Some people with dysphagia use the term chalky to describe a texture that makes pills difficult to take. What they might be saying, I think, is that the pill becomes sticky when it gets a little wet, and then it won't go down easily, especially if the patient has impaired salivation or doesn't drink water with it. A solution is often to put a coating on the pill, and that improves the swallowability. 79% of older persons would prefer a coated over an uncoated tablet. Soft tablets with a gel coating are especially preferred by patients, but those can get sticky in a dry mouth. And then there's other issues. Shape, it turns out, is important. Older persons with swallowing problems say that a torpedo-shaped tablet or capsule goes down the best. Finally, there's the issue of taste. We've all heard the saying, you know, it's a bitter pill to swallow. And indeed, the drug industry has done a lot of work on this. I remember when I was a kid, like every pill was bitter. But nowadays, we have more capsules and coatings to hide the taste, and we only give pills usually when the taste is not too obnoxious. But we just have to be aware, especially if we're giving granules or tablets to people or crushing them. So many things to think about pill size, shape, texture, taste. The main value of this review to me was to remind me how important it is to think about medication formulation when ordering a prescription. And if a patient is being non-adherent to a regimen, asking why.
Yeah, you know, we in medicine, we do so many things to our patients. This paper really gives us a pause and you know, forces us to ask, what is the common sense thing to do for our patients? So really, really interesting article. Thank you.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
Let's move on to our last topic for today. As we all know, the COVID-19 pandemic has shined a sad and unfortunate, unkind light on the post-acute and long-term care system in this country. This has led to a lot of questions around whether and if the system can ever be changed. And some are asking about this time of national crisis being a natural time to think about maybe transformation in the post-acute and long-term care setting. Dr. Sloan, I understand that you feel that two papers in the August 2020 issue of JAMDA are particularly germane to this question, and that one is highly practical and patient-centered from a Baltimore team in post-acute and long-term care, and the other as more theoretical, using human factors analysis, a theoretical term that's foreign to me.
Well, that's right, Wayne. Now, the first paper involves an analysis of infection control practices in nursing home ventilator units. And the other reports the results of a conference on re-envisioning post-acute care.
All right, so how about if we start with maybe some practical, maybe even mundane considerations and proceed to the theoretical. Tell us about the analysis of ventilator unit practice and what messages it provides for our listeners.
Well, this was another fascinating study for me. And a team of human factors specialists observed procedures in three nursing home ventilator units. Now, for those who may not know what human factors is, which I didn't until a few years ago, it's an academic specialty that studies how to improve the safety, efficiency, and productivity of interactions between people in various products, processes, machines, things like that. Ergonomics, which we most of us know that word, it's the application of human factors to the design of such things as office furniture. In this study, a team of human factors engineering experts went into three nursing home units to examine the process of tracheostomy care. They looked at the work system, environment, tools, technologies, policies, procedures, staff, tasks. They examined patient and employee outcomes. Each of the three vent units they studied had between 10 and 12 ventilator care beds, with one respiratory therapist on duty per shift, who is responsible for most tracheostomy care and most suctioning. Registered nurses were on duty, of course, and they could suction on an as-needed basis. In each setting, two human factors experts and an ID specialist, with a focus on long-term care infection prevention, analyzed the care through observation over many days. They also conducted focus group sessions with the staff in each unit, walking through each step in the respiratory care process. The result, like many reports, was rather voluminous. However, perhaps because of their discipline, because it's so practical, the report defined things that were really good take-home messages. They featured a list of the five activities that they observed not being done properly, which in their analysis were of the highest priority to change. Now, before I go further, I want to mention, you know, I understand many of the people who are listening to AMDA on the go may not be associated with a ventilator unit in a nursing home, but chances are you have somebody who goes to one, you refer to one, or in some way you have some contact with one, because they are highly prized in terms of being available when needed. And as you may recall, the January 2020 issue of JAMDA included an article from scientists at the CDC that reported ventilator units to be far and away the biggest source of multi-drug resistant outbreaks that the CDC was called in to investigate. So I think this important information about the nursing home industry in general, and especially for those of you who work within these settings. Based on their analysis, here's what they determined to be the ventilator unit care areas that most needed improvement. Now, I also should say they used a very interesting formula to determine this top five. They looked for things based on how bad it is if they were not done or were done wrong, how frequently they happen, and the likelihood that the lapse in care will be overlooked by the staff. Now, interesting, you know, maybe that's not a bad way to think about where you prioritize your QI. Hmm. You know, how bad it is if it's not done right, how frequently it happens, and the likelihood that it will be missed if it's not done. Well, anyway, here's their list. Number one was consistent use of gloves for all procedures. Is that, have we ever heard that before? And clean, sterile gloves for residents with an open trach. But then they looked at factors contributing to it, and they found that some people thought, well, it might not matter to use an unsterile glove for this thing, or the gloves weren't immediately available, they had time pressure. Those were the kind of main factors. Number two was hand hygiene. Now, have we heard about that before? Hmm. But once again, contributing factors were lack of knowledge of proper procedures, the people cycle in and out, attitudes such as thinking that gloves were sufficient, you know, well, I got my gloves on, so I don't need to wash, time pressure, and lack of ready hand sanitizer availability. Number three was incorrect use of intermittent suction as a catheter was being withdrawn. Now this is getting kind of into things that I'm not an expert on, but they basically, you know, you have to be careful when you use suction, when you're not, if you're withdrawing the catheter. Contributing factors included lack of knowledge about pressure thresholds for suctioning, lack of training on new equipment, equipment problems, distractions such as talking to a family member, or the complexity of the task. Now the fourth was assessing and detecting resident distress. People would miss that. Contributing factors included work distraction, like the family member, environmental clutter. In one unit, they had a brown paper cover that they put over the suction container so that people would see the gross stuff coming in. And it was supposed to comfort the family, but what happened was it blocked the view of the suction material so the staff couldn't tell, you know, what was going on. Number five was not wearing a face shield. Contributing factors included lack of knowledge of guidelines, merely forgetting to put it on, lack of a policy under a training covering face use of these face shields, lack of signage designated need for a face shield, and lack of ready availability of face shield supplies.
Yikes.
Yeah, you can imagine with COVID, these kinds of things are happening more and more, are more and more issues that we really want to be careful about.
Wow.
In early event units, but in other settings as well. So although, you know, only a fraction of nursing homes have vent units, this is an area where the need for strict infection control is vital, and there are a lot of lessons from this article, I think, for everybody.
Wow. So, and as you said, especially around COVID-19, that's in, you know, extended the need for increased infection control, personal hygiene, use of PPE. That's a trinity that's going to be in our world for a very, very long time. So let's move on to our final paper, results of a think tank on re-envisioning long-term care led by some heavy hitters in post-acute and long-term care. Tell me, Dr. Sloan, what does this paper tell us?
Well, I'm going to try to go to the bottom line of these things because there's a lot to talk about, and we can talk forever about how long-term care could change. So I'm going to talk about two questions that they were asked. The first question was, if you had the power to do away with the current long-term care system and create post-acute care from scratch, what would it look like?
Wow.
Yeah, and here are their main points. First of all, and I think we'll all agree with this, change reimbursement so that long-term care is covered just like other medical settings. They point out that current Medicare reimbursement policy creates silos. They recommend that payment models blend all post-acute and long-term care services. That's the first recommendation. The second is to invest in post-acute care training to match the need of post-acute patients. Now, as you mentioned earlier, our patients are changing. They're getting much more complex. And this echoes on what we learned from the previous paper, which pointed out that lack of training was a frequent contributing factor to lapses in care of nursing home residents on ventilators. The third point was the recommendation was expand the community role for nursing facilities. I thought this was kind of intriguing as an idea. Why not make the skilled nursing facility part of a system of post-acute and long-term care that was truly integrated, included adult daycare, assisted living, PACE, and home-based care? I know a few integrated health systems are doing this well, but I don't think it's happening that often.
You know, what's interesting about this paper is that mirrors what the post-acute long-term care medicine society has been advocating for years. And if you look at the authors of this paper, including Dr. Kerry Levy, a past president, and Dr. Bob Burke, who's a hospitalist and a policy expert from Pennsylvania, and his work on transitions, they've been talking about this stuff for years. You know, but I was also thinking that, you know, maybe even working more closely, the long-term care setting, with insurance plans. You know, obviously Medicare and Medicaid are the ones that come to mind. But how about those that cater to special needs populations and those folks who are duly eligible in Medicare and Medicaid, for whom care delivery at home needs to be optimized? This has been an idea for the Society's Transitions of Care Committee for years that it's worked on and published on in the past. And leaders like Lee Lindquist from Northwestern University has talked about optimizing the community with better relations. So community and skilled nursing, it's potentially an amazing synergy.
Yes, and very important, you know, as we do more and more community-based care, which everybody pretty much loves. And let's face it, it's the people who need healthcare the most. They're the ones that bounce back and forth between different settings. So these Absolutely. Transitional care is so important.
Absolutely.
Well, to move on, the second question the conference addressed was, if a landmark study or initiative or policy change, if something was changed and occurred in 2024 and you made it happen, what would that change be and how did you make it happen? Well, my answer would be, I don't know if I have that kind of power, but before COVID came along, I would have said nothing's going to happen to long-term care. It's been frustrating to have been doing this for so many decades. But on the other hand, a landmark change, maybe that could happen because people's eyes have been opened about the frailty, the vulnerability of people who are in long-term care and the necessity of having long-term care settings. So let's hope that increased flexibility doesn't go away. That's happened already. And let's really hope that people think more about this. But anyway, when they were asked what they thought was most likely to change, if anything, they thought that encouraging innovation and reducing policy and regulation barriers would be number one.
Yeah.
We've actually seen that happen.
Yes. You know? Yeah.
With COVID, it's been incredible. And I just hope that that spirit continues. This panel's second response was capture data at the point of care, perhaps even daily. At first, that sounds a little bit like pointy-headed, but on the other hand, and then we didn't have enough detail for me to understand, but the idea was to gather regularly the data that is most useful in identifying problems and driving improvement. If we take the example of the ventilator units we talked about a few minutes ago, imagine if the units started collecting data daily on the five biggest problems that the human factors and analysts identified. You know, they would find out pretty quickly and they would monitor what was happening with hand washing, what was happening with glove use, what was happening with the suctioning procedure, and it would change quickly. So there, I think they've got a point there. Mm. If we could just do it. The devil's always in the details. So response number three was to focus interventions on the most relevant patient concerns and conditions. Well, that makes sense. This is what I've long believed is a key role for attending physicians and medical directors. Now, we're in the nursing home, and there is never enough time for the staff to do everything. So leadership needs to identify priorities for staff and help focus on them. This conference identified increased attention to frailty and more palliative care consultations in skilled nursing facilities as two areas they thought should be considered. Yeah. We could have a whole other hour on that.
I mean, it's already well known how impactful palliative care is in the skilled nursing setting, and only for patients and residents with serious illness. I'm frankly still amazed that we're still requiring a think tank to ponder the merits of palliative care.
I'm with you on that.
Well, that wraps it up for this August 2020 issue of the JAMDA On The Go podcast. And under the leadership of co-editors in-chief, Dr. Philip Sloan and Dr. Cheryl Zimmerman, and with the support of editors like Dr. Mallory Brown, the Journal of the American Medical Director Association continues to be an impactful resource in post-acute and long-term care and beyond. Take a look at the August 2020 issue. Dr. Sloan and Dr. Brown, thank you for spending again your time with JAMDA On The Go.
Thanks, Wayne.
It was our pleasure.
References for this podcast can be found at www.jamda.com. And until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for JAMDA On The Go.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post Acute Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, go to our new learning management system at apex.paltc.org. Click on podcast and follow the link to this latest episode. Thank you.